Welcome to Rockin' the Music World. I'm Robert Lloyd.
Get on the left, get on the right, turn on the radio and join in the fight. Sort out the lies, seek out the truth. On the radio, they're giving the proof. You're gonna love it, hate it, it can confuse. First time you try it, it can give you the blues. But take my word, you can call and abuse. Just keep on talking news. Yeah.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Rockin' the Music World. I'm Robert Lloyd. I think I already said that once. Got a good show for you this week. You know, we want to bring you the culture of the upper European ancestry, what we have given the world. And we should be so proud of everything we have done. You know, we put a man on the moon. We discovered America. We've given the world Beethoven, Bach, Wagner, Johann Strauss Jr. We have given you Sir Isaac Newton, given the printing press, maybe the most Gutenberg's printing press, maybe the most important invention in the history of the world. We've given the world Thomas Edison. We have given the world the character of George Washington and Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. If you've ever read about these people, these are very, very important people that we should all study. Of all races, everybody from every race should understand who these people are. And Aristotle, just an assortment of people that have given so much to the world. And today, I thought I would talk about two people. I just picked two out of the hat. It doesn't necessarily, these aren't the only two like this, but these are two of the very best. And this is a music show for people that love music, and not the screaming World Wrestling Federation garbage stuff, and not the rap crap. I'm talking beautiful music, and this show is dedicated to that for all you listeners out there that understand, and this show is close to your heart for that reason. We don't have a lot of shows in the world that we can go to, but we can always come here. And I think I'm talking to people that understand, that come to the show and listen to what I'm offering here every week. And I just love doing this, and I hope people enjoy the show and give comments to know I'm getting through out there to some people. But today we're going to be talking about music producers. Producers are the equivalent of, as a movie director, the director controls everything going on in a movie, right? In the music world, that person is not called a music director, he's called a music producer. In movies, the producer is the person that puts the money up. In here, the producer in the music business gives direction like a movie director does. So that's the difference. So we're going to talk about music producers today. And I'm going to give two of the very best in their fields. Totally different people in total different genres. But both very, very important. I'm going to talk in the country field, Mr. Owen Bradley. He is my favorite country producer of all time. Then we have the second half of the show will be about the best rock producer, one of the best rock producers. It's hard to say who is the best, but happens to be maybe my favorite, Sir George Martin. Yes, the Beatles producer, and Jerry and the Pacemakers producer, and people such as that. Owen Bradley and George Martin, their careers kind of overlapped in a time. Owen Bradley was a little earlier, but his later in his career, he overlapped with George Martin. One, of course, country, one, of course, in the pop rock field. And both were very, very important, and I'm going to show you how important these two people were. So I'm going to start off with Owen Bradley today. First half of the show will be Mr. Bradley. He was born October 21st, 1915, and he died early in 1998. Was an American record producer and one of the chief architects of the 1950s and 1960s Nashville country music sound, the Nashville sound, and also rockabilly. He was a part of that. He was a native of Westmoreland, Tennessee, and Bradley learned piano at an early age and became fairly good at it, and he could be playing in local nightclubs and roadhouses when he was just a teenager. At the age of 20 years old, he worked as an arranger and musician when he got a job at the unbelievable WSM-AM radio. The mega radio station of all country music out of Nashville, Tennessee, and he was one of the early ones that worked there. In 1947, he took a position as a music arranger and songwriter at Decca Records, the same Decca Records that said to the Beatles when the Beatles auditioned for him, the record executive said, "We don't like the sound. Groups with guitars are on their way out." So much for record executives. But nevertheless, Owen Bradley. Now there's an interesting guy. And he first worked for a guy named Paul Cohen, unfortunately. And he was worked on some of the recordings by some of the biggest talents of the day, such as Ernest Tubb, Burl Ives, Mr. In Between, Red Foley, There Will Be Peace, and Kitty Wells. Learning from Cohen, unfortunately, but y'all start somewhere. And he eventually began to produce records on his own. And when when Paul Cohen, his mentor, left the label in 1958, Bradley became vice president of Decca's Nashville division and began pioneering what would be called the Nashville sound. Country music had been looked on as unsophisticated, folksy. My mother would have said, hayseed. Yeah, you had to know my mother. But my stepfather loved country music, and I grew up walking through our house as a kid, and my stepdad would have his country music playing downstairs in the basement in the wintertime. He'd be working and in the garage out during the summertime, and it was nice. He loved his country music, and I was kind of a Beatles fan, of course. And I would be kind of going, what's this? What's this? But I'd be hearing all these songs. He was a big Johnny Cash fan, Stonewall Jackson, you know, A Wound Time Can't Erase. And I loved, you know, Waterloo, you know, things like that that Stonewall Jackson did. Jim Reeves, He'll Have to Go. And my dad loved country music, you know, and so even though I rejected it as a kid, like, you know, most kids do at the time, you wanted rock and roll, I knew every country song there was. KOOO out of Omaha, Nebraska was on 24/7, and I... You know, when I finally became a professional musician in the 70s, you know, this long-haired rocker, you know, I had more of a deeper voice anyway when I would sing, kind of an Elvish, a lot of people said Elvis, Gordon Lightfoot combination type of voice, and that's fine. I used to resent being called anything, but eventually you understand people are just trying to describe your voice, and that's fine, but... I mean, I knew every country song there was, and in my rock band, sometimes we'd play country songs just for the fun of it to shock people. And I just knew country music. You know, as much as I knew the rock world, I knew country music, and I knew the songs, and I knew the good stuff and the garbage, I just loved it. So it was something I could always fall back on. And on occasion, then I'd do a single thing in between bands or something. Bands are always breaking up, you know. And as a single, you would do more country because, you know, it's more of a 3-4-5 chord type thing with a voice. If you could sing, you know, people would recognize the melodic melodies, the melodic melodies. How's that for a phrase? And you know, I made my living that way. You know, I absolutely preferred playing in bands because I love the complexities of harmonies and counter voicings and stuff like that. And I love playing with great musicians. I was an average musician instrumentally. I mean, as a songwriter, I'm a good instrumentalist guitar player as a songwriter. But compared to guys that are you know, absolutely instrumentalist, I mean, they're out of my league, and I love playing. I've always surrounded myself with great musicians. Even in the recording studio, I always surrounded myself with great musicians. And there's some things that I can play that other people can't, and sometimes I would play certain things. But for the most part, I love having good musicians with me. And you know, they can make you or break you, but, you know, you got to have a rapport also, and I certainly did with the people that played with me. Getting back to Owen Bradley, I'm sorry, I get off these tangents. Anyway, it was, you know, looked at country music at the time, unsophisticated, and hayseed, as my mother would say. And here comes Owen Bradley, and when he was on the keyboard and stuff, and he started bringing in this type of music. Instead of just a fiddle, he would bring in violins. Same instrument, isn't it? But it's played totally different, in a sense. A great fiddler can be a great violinist, and a great violinist can be a great fiddler. But when you're doing soundtracks, for instance, with Patsy Cline...
I've got your picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got your picture, she's got you. I've got the records that we used to share.
The beautiful strings. Not that she was a credit to it. She didn't know the first thing from a hit song or anything. She was a dork in that stuff. I mean, she, as I said in one of the previous shows, you know, she liked the yodel. If she could have yodeled every song, that's what she would have done. And Bradley is the one that took her under his wing and started finding great songs by people like Harlan Howard and Willie Nelson, people that could really write, and got some classy music with great arrangements, with some great, his brother, for instance, was on bass. He'd have Floyd Kramer, his brother was Harold, a great bass player. I mean, you can hear it on some of those early Nashville sound recordings that they did. And he brought in the country-politan sound that some people didn't like. Other people like me just loved it. I loved the sophisticated side of country. Not the, I don't know. I'm not really a honky-tonker, per se, even though I made my living in bars, unfortunately. I didn't even drink. I was the only person at 2 o'clock in the morning that was sober. Went to a bar every single night, starting at 9:30, whenever we'd start playing in the evening, and I was stone sober. Didn't smoke and didn't drink. I after I got out of the music business and worked in the business world, I thought I'd be sociable and take up drinking. So about for about 10 years, I drank. That was stupid, dumb. But anyway. I played in bars with a bunch of drinkers, but I love playing music. And I've been doing it all my life, and to this day, I still write and record and once in a while play at special functions. Anyway, getting once again back to Owen Bradley. He started this Nashville sound, and he had a attached to his house, owned by his brother Harold on 16th Avenue South, which is Music Row. But at the time, it was just a little neighborhood, and there was what they called a Quonset hut attached to the house, and they call this almost the birthplace of commercial country music that often crossed over into pop. But it was at this place, 804 16th Avenue South in Nashville, the Quonset Hut. And this is Owen Bradley and his brother and other. They started this whole thing of country music getting out into the world because you had to have somebody recording things, right? And they were the guys. Bradley's crew of hand-picked musicians were Grady Martin, Bob Moore, Hank Garland, and Buddy Harmon. They were called Nashville's A-Team. Well, I wasn't there, so I guess they were the A-Team because I wasn't there. But anyway, joking aside, this success of the Quonset Hut Studio spurred RCA Victor to build its famous RCA Studio B there also. And a handful of other labels soon followed, setting up shop on what would eventually become known as the world-renowned Music Row. And folks, it's there. If you take a vacation to Nashville, and you can go up and down that street, and you'll see banners celebrating certain hit songs outside the houses. They kind of look like just a neighborhood house, but you can tell there's other things going on there because they'll have, you know, their signs out front and stuff showing, you know, who this is. A very, very interesting place. I love taking a vacation to Nashville on occasion. Bradley and his contemporaries infused hokey melodies with more refined lyrics and blended them with a refined pop music sensibility to create the Nashville sound known later as country. Dreepolitan, as I already said. Light, easy listening piano. I hate easy listening anything. I don't like that term popularized by Floyd Kramer. But you'll hear some of his handiwork, folks. I'll have some of that going on here. Replaced the clinky, clunky honky-tonk piano. But sometimes honky-tonk piano is kind of nice. It's fun. The lush string sections took the place of the mountain fiddle sounds. Steel guitars and smooth backing vocals rounded out the mix. Remember, the Jordanaires were part of that. That backed up Elvis Presley. They did a lot of work in Nashville also. Love those background vocals. Regarding the Nashville sound, Owen Bradley stated, "Now we've cut out the fiddle and steel guitar and added choruses to country music. But it can't stop there. It always has to keep developing to keep fresh." I agree. Don't ever get stuck in a mold. Don't ever do it. The Beatles wouldn't allow it. Don't ever allow that, folks. Always reach out. I mean, all these monkey see, monkey do musicians, the karaoke stars of Nashville now in pop music. They're not talented. They're soap opera good looks with Hallmark card lyrics for their songs. Stupid if I've ever heard it. Meaningless. But, that's what we're getting in the true great dramatic artist. Are pretty much, you're going to have immorality. You're going to have some outrageousness in a sense, but it's nothing that you admire. That's what we're getting these days. But anyway, going on, some of the singers Bradley produced made unprecedented headway into radio, and artists such as my favorite, Patsy Cline.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted, and then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
Brenda Lee, Loretta Lynn, and even Conway Twitty, the guy that said it all starts with a song, and he was absolutely, absolutely right. And these all became household names nationwide and worldwide. As you're listening right now, you certainly know many older artists, and then they recognized they needed the change as they saw former pure honky tonk singer Jim Reeves blend his own style with the newer styles with great success. Jim Reeves, for a large part, was also, he was produced by Chet Atkins, by the way. And Jim Reeves was a beautiful, smooth as silk singer. And a lot of that was a result because of the country-politan sound that came in. Pop singers like Buddy Holly and Gene Vincent also recorded with Bradley. Bradley sold eventually the Quonset Hut to Columbia, which today is a division of Sony BMG. Once we're getting back to the big three, there's only three people in the world that own music anymore, and bought a farm outside of Nashville in 1961, converting a barn into a demo studio. Within a few years, the new Bradley's Barn became a legendary recording venue in country music circles. It burned to the ground in 1980, but Bradley rebuilt it within a few years in the same location.
Hello, darling. Nice to see you. It's been a long time. You're just as lovely as you used to be. How's your new love? Are you happy? Hope you're doing fine. Just to know it means so much to me.
what's that, darling? How am I doing? Guess I'm doing all right, except I can't sleep and I cry all night till dawn. What I'm trying to say is I love you and I miss you and I'm so sorry that I did you wrong. Look up, darling, let me kiss you, just for old time's sake, let me hold you in my arms one more time. Thank you, darling, may God bless you, and may each step you take bring you closer to the thing. Goodbye, darling. Gotta go now. Gotta try to find a way to lose these memories of a love so warm and true. And if you should ever find it in your heart to forgive me, come back, darling. I'll be waiting for you.
Oh boy, in 1974, Owen Bradley was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. His production of Patsy Cline's legendary hits like Crazy, written by Willie Nelson, by the way, I Fall to Pieces. After Midnight, not one of my favorite. She's Got You. I love that song. That's one of his also that he produced. Remained a more than 40 years of the standard against the great female country records are measured today. And very few can match up to that. And I think proudly we can say that. With Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn, he's best known for the Coal Miner's Daughter and the film Sweet Dreams. And he was chosen to direct their soundtracks, which of course he should have done. When he did, they were great movies. 1997, the Metro Parks Authority in Nashville dedicated a small public park between 16th Avenue South and Division Street, right there on Music Row, to Owen Bradley, where his bronze likeness sits at a bronze piano. Owen Bradley Park is at the northern end of Music Row. God bless and let him rest in peace. Let us now go to Sir George, Henry Martin, George Martin, folks. born January 3rd, 1926, and he's alive today and in good health, as I understand. And he was one of the first huge record producers of the world, and he came about it in a very odd way, but he's the one that was with the Beatles in the very beginning. He's the one that complained about their initial drummer, Pete Best, wasn't a professional drummer, and he talked to them about it, and they brought in Ringo Starr instead. And that was a very important change that was unpopular at the time among the local set, but something that, as I understand, had to be done. He's an English record producer, arranger, composer, conductor, audio engineer, and musician. He is sometimes referred to as the Fifth Beatle, a title that he has described as nonsense in reference to his extensive involvement on each of the Beatles' original albums. He is considered one of the greatest record producers of all time, with 30 number one hit singles in the UK and 23 number one hits in the United States. And he could have had as many as he wants, but eventually you want to move on. You don't want to just continue doing the same thing all the time. And he's still in the production on occasion. He has lost some of his hearing, and that has affected his work. Anyway, when he was 6 years old, Martin's family acquired a piano that sparked his interest in music. And at 8 years of age, Martin persuaded his parents that he should take piano lessons. But those ended after only 8 lessons because of a disagreement between his mother and the teacher. I wonder what happened there. After that, Martin explained that he had just picked it up by himself. Boy, I wish my parents would have just acquired a piano when I was 6 or 8 years old. Man, another story. I'm not going to go into it right now, folks. One of my shows in the future, I'm going to talk about the time my parents had the chance to get an upright piano, an old one for free, didn't do it, and didn't tell me about it for 20 years. Anyway, according to Martin, I remember well the very first time I heard a symphony orchestra. I was just in my teens when Sir Adrian Bolt brought the BBC Symphony Orchestra to my school for a public concert. It was absolutely magical. Hearing such glorious sounds, I found it difficult to connect them with 90 men and women blowing into brass and wooden instruments or scraping away at strings with horsehair bows. Anyway, Martin attended eventually the Guildhall School of Music and Drama from 47 to 1950. He studied piano and oboe, of all things. Following his graduation, he worked for the BBC's Classical Music Department, then joined EMI in 1950. Martin first produced comedy and novelty records in the early 1950s, working with the likes of Peter Sellers, this isn't one of his productions, but he worked with Peter Sellers, remember him in the Pink Panther, and Spike Milligan. Despite Martin's continued interest in music and fantasies about being the next Rachmaninoff, he did not initially choose music as a career. He worked briefly as a quantity surveyor, and then for the War Office as a temporary clerk, which meant filing paperwork and making tea. In 1943, when he was 17, he joined the Royal Navy and actually became a pilot and a commissioned officer. But the war ended before Martin was involved in any combat, and he got out of the service around 1947. But he used his a veteran's grant to attend his music and drama school, and so he came out pretty good with that. There's a Sid Coleman of Ardmore and Beechwood early in 1962, contacted George Martin, who told him about this guy named Brian Epstein. Brian Epstein's a Jewish manager of the Beatles. He found them early on when people came into his record store asking for Beatle records, and the Beatles didn't have any records, but the people loved them. And he was the manager of this rock band. He thought Martin might be interested in the group, even though they had been turned down by Decca Records. Remember what I said about Decca Records turning them down, among other major British labels. Until that time, although he'd had considerable success with the comedy records and a number one hit with the Temperance Seven, Martin had only one minor success with pop music. So why did they choose him? Maybe because he was more approachable, because he wasn't a star yet. Martin listened to a tape recorded at Decca and thought that Epstein's group was rather unpromising. But like the sound of Lennon and McCartney's vocals, that kind of surprises me, but that's good. After another meeting with Epstein on the 9th of May at the Abbey Road Studios, Martin was impressed with Epstein's enthusiasm and agreed to sign the unknown Beatles to a recording contract without having met them or seen them play live. Now that is something. Now, the Beatles were not that impressive at that. They were just basically doing cover tunes. So, but anyway, they eventually signed them. But Martin would not sign it, the contract with the Beatles themselves until he had heard their audition. He said that EMI had nothing to lose, as it only offered one penny for each record sold, which was split among the four members. And then Martin suggested to EMI after the release of With Love From Me to You that the royalty rate should be doubled without asking for anything in return, which led Martin to be thought of as a traitor in EMI. You know, think about who owns EMI, folks. And Martin knew the Beatles and Epstein. He didn't have any experience signing groups to record labels. They were taken for a ride here. They were cheated. And Martin wanted just immediately double the royalty rate on these, and EMI considered him scum. Well, God bless George Martin. He did a good thing. Anyway, finally, the Beatles auditioned for Martin on June 6, 1962, in Studio 3 at the Abbey Road Studios. And along with some engineers, they recorded four songs, which Martin, who was not present during the recordings, listened to at the end of the session. The verdict was not promising, according to Martin. However, as they were complaining about Pete Best drumming, and Martin thought their original songs were simply not good enough. Martin asked the individual Beatles if there was anything they personally did not like, and George Harrison spoke up and said, "Well, there's your tie for a start." George Harrison was very, very dry sense of humor. I love that. But that was the turning point. All these quips that the Beatles would throw at George Martin, making fun of this older guy and you know, the guy in a suit and tie, and the Beatles just laughed about that stuff and would just joke around in the studio. Their studio work a lot of times was very upbeat and everything, which I always like in a studio. I don't like real absolute seriousness. I don't like, you know, critical and tempers and stuff. I don't like that in a recording studio. I like having fun in a studio because, to me, that's the closest thing to heaven I'll ever get here on earth. And I don't like if someone brings in negative waves. And I don't have it, and the Beatles normally didn't have it until Yoko Ono walked in one day. And that destroyed the recording process, and it was never the same. Anyway, he loved the Beatles, and they signed him to a contract, he said, for their wit alone. He liked them so much. Anyway, they released Love Me Do, and it peaked at number 17 in the charts. And so in 1962, in November, Martin then recorded Please Please Me. which he only did after Lennon McCartney almost begged him to record another of their original songs. Now, Love Me Do, the Beatles knew, wasn't a great hit. The record label chose it, and George Martin chose it as the first release, merely because it had John Lennon playing the harmonica on it, and they thought, okay, that'd be a little different maybe, so they'll release it. Not really understanding that you always release the best song. People are going to gravitate to the best song. John Lennon knew Please Please Me was going to be a hit. After they recorded it, he had already called his friends and family and said, we've got a number one hit. Now, George Martin knew it was a good one after they finally recorded it. But again, Lennon McCartney had to beg for the thing to be done. Martin's crucial contribution to the song was to tell them to speed up what was initially a slow ballad. And if there's anything I can do, if there's anything, oh, that you want, if there's anything I can do, you know, that's a very up-tempo song, and it was initially done by the band as a slow ballad. I never heard that version. But so Martin says, hey, why don't you do it as an up-tempo? And they did, and it was really catchy, a lovely song. And so Martin played the song in the style of Bach, which I'm not sure, to show McCartney the voicings that were available. He did this also on, like, Penny Lane, which had the piccolo trumpet solo. McCartney hummed the melody he wanted, and then Martin wrote it down in music notation for Dave Mason, the classically trained trumpeter, which he did that on Penny Lane. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. But anyway, back to Please Please Me. They sped this up, and then Martin was looking over the mixing desk at the Beatles, and he looked at him and said, gentlemen, you have just made your first number one record. And, of course, the Beatles loved that. Martin's musical expertise helped fill the gaps between the Beatles' raw talent and the sound they wanted to achieve. Most of the Beatles' orchestra arrangements and instrumentation were written and performed by Martin in collaboration with the band. Yesterday, for instance, McCartney just wanted a guitar vocal, is all he wanted. And Martin says, oh, wait a second, we can bring in a string quartet and have cellos and violins and stuff. And McCartney wasn't sure, but Martin stuck with it and finally sold him on it. Of course, the rest is history. It's one of the all-time biggest recordings in the history of the world. And part of it was the beautiful production that George Martin put in there. Anyway, Martin's distinctive arranging work appears on many Beatles recordings. Thank God he came from a classical background. I would love to have a person like that producing me, because I love the classical work intertwined with the rock world. Eleanor Rigby, I'm going to play a little bit of that. He scored and conducted a strings-only accompaniment inspired by a guy named Bernard Herrmann. On a Canadian speaking tour in 2007, Martin said his Eleanor Rigby score was influenced by Herrmann's score for the Alfred Hitchcock thriller Psycho. Then he went on to talk about Strawberry Fields Forever. Engineer Jeff Emmerich, who should be another, possibly I should have a show just on Jeff Emmerich, who was the engineer on many of the Beatles stuff and work. He was the right-hand man for George Martin. And they turned to two very different takes on a single master. through varying speeds. He did that on Strawberry Fields. They combined two songs that were not even in the same key. They sped up one and slowed up the other to match them and put them together because John Lennon wanted it that way. He just said, George, fix it. And so they had to figure out technically how to do it. You know, it wasn't the digital world at that time, and they did it. On I Am the Walrus, it was George that provided the quirky brass, violins, cellos, and supplied the Mike Sam singers for the vocals, you know, all those crazy words that and sounds that I talked about. I think it was on last week's show, in fact. On In My Life, I've Loved You More. Remember that song?
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places have their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall some are dead and some living.
He played a sped-up Baroque piano solo. He worked with McCartney to implement the orchestral climax in A Day in the Life, and he and McCartney shared conducting duties the day it was recorded. Very interesting. Just love that stuff. By the way, In My Life, I love the song. I think it's a bad production. I've always thought the drums were too clumpy, too heavy in that thing, and it could have been such a more beautiful, smoother song if they would have remixed it. Now, if I ever have the chance to remix it, if they ever ask me to, I'd love to come in and remix it and really put that song into outer space. Martin also, years later, was the post-production editor on the Beatles anthology series, which originally was entitled The Long and Winding Road, which, of course, he wasn't the producer on that. Phil Spector was, and it was kind of hurt Martin's feelings. When he was busy, he couldn't do it, so McCartney went to somebody else for that
the
recording
long
session.
And winding road. Disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door. The wild and windy
And then he was working again with Jeff Emmerich, the engineer. And for the project, they decided to use an old 8-track analog deck to mix the songs. And EMI just didn't understand that. They had the modern digital stuff, but Martin said they wanted this because the old deck created a completely different sound, which a new deck could not recreate. He also said the whole project was a strange experience for him, with Paul McCartney totally agreed. And as they listened to themselves chatting in the studio 20 to 30 years previously, that was something new even for McCartney, that they didn't know they had all this stuff available. Martin produced recordings for many other artists too, not just the Beatles, but Matt Monro from Russia with Love. Remember that, the James Bond? That was Matt Monro singing. Cilla Black, Jerry and the Pacemakers. I love this one, Ferry Cross the Mersey.
Life goes on day after day. Hearts torn in every way. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay. People, they rush everywhere, each with their own secret care. So ferry across the Mersey, and always take me there, the place I love. People around every corner, they seem to smile and say, we don't care what your name is, boy, we'll never turn you away. So I'll continue to say, so ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay, and here I'll stay, here I'll stay.
The band America, guitarist Jeff Beck, country singer Kenny Rogers, and then rockers Cheap Trick from back in the 70s and 80s. Remember them? Martin was also directly and indirectly involved in the in three films for the James Bond series. Although he didn't do the From Russia with Love series, he was responsible for the signing of Matt Monro to EMI just prior to this being done. Martin also produced two of the best-known James Bond themes. The first was Goldfinger, remember that, by Shirley Bassey, 1964. Goldfinger, and that was a beautiful soundtrack that George Martin did. And the second, in 1973, was Live and Let Die. Remember that, by Paul McCartney, when he did that? And the film of the same name. And he also composed and produced the film score. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Sir George Martin. Well, that's my show for the day, folks, for the week. And I hope you enjoyed this information on the people that actually are involved, not as an artist, but as maybe a minor artist to contribute to soundtracks and then produce. And they're like the coach of a football team. They're telling these great athletes and great musicians as a musician. Instead of the great athlete on the football field, they become the great musicians and singers and songwriters. And the football coach then becomes the producer in the recording studio. And the football coach slash producer is Owen Bradley in country. He was one of the greats. And Sir George Martin of England and the rock world. Of course, he was then knighted by the Queen of England, and that's how he became Sir George. Now, I'm not real big on royalty titles. I'll just play along here with a little smirk. I don't believe an American should ever bow down to anybody, including our tennis players that go to Wimbledon and curtsy and bow down to the Queen. I think that if our players have to do that, they should be escorted around the Queen so they don't have to be disrespectful, but they should also understand we don't bow. Americans do not bow to any man nor woman. And I'll probably have a show on that one of these days. I don't think we should ever do it.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's Rockin' the Music World. I had a good time as always. I love music, folks. I hope you love music too, and you're learning from this series and this show. And if there's anything you want me to cover that maybe I haven't, that you have some ideas, send me an email. Post it on the comments section in the website here. I read everyone and I comment on a lot of them. And even if I don't comment, I read everyone and I understand what's going on. And I just love doing this. I love music. I love rocking the music world with Robert Lloyd. I'll see you next week.
Every morning, lifting the morning with you.